Good afternoon. I'd like to introduce Mr. Hirsch to all of you. He's a scholar of literature, and he's professor of modern German literature and qualitative media analysis at the University of Mannheim. He's written on money, money in literature, money and the media. My first question then is, what does literature have to do with the topic of money, debt, guilt, liabilities? Well, literature is strange media. It can talk about anything. There's no subject that doesn't fit into literature. That's always something which makes us feel awkward as literature scholars, or perhaps megalomaniac. We can talk about anything. We just hide behind the major texts, the classics, and that means that debt and guilt are very much represented in high literature and classical literature, and the more we esteem this, Shakespeare, Goethe, Thomas Mann, Brecht, the more we're dealing with guilt and debts. It's also the question of whether topics such as guilt, moral guilt, historic guilt, or the notion of value, cultural values, religious values, this is a value I'm willing to die for. You deserve love. That's also a notion of value. And the question is, are these terms just a linguistic game? Okay, we're philosophers, we're going to draw a distinction between the terms as separate terms. Or can we say, well, there's a substantive basis for the fact that these terms oscillate so much? Can you take this notion of guilt and transpose it to the economy? This nexus linking guilt and debt, there's no point in looking at CEOs and saying to them, oh, well, don't build up guilt against poor people, don't exploit them. They just nod happily and say, well, how am I supposed to do it if you look at return on investment and so on? So how is it possible to take the economic sphere and make it more aware of the questions of the non-economic sphere? The good Mensch of Sechuan, for example, or Die Heilige Johanna, the Holy Johanna, that we're morally have integrity, but it doesn't function. And can literature resolve the crises which capitalism has for us? Well, I'm flattered that you think I'd be able to answer this question on behalf of literature. Well, of course, no. But actually, I'll say yes, as a matter of fact. Thomas Mann's novel, Königliche Hoheit, is my favorite novel. The Buddenbrooks is all about how to run a business or how to make a mess of it. Königliche Hoheit is not about business management any longer. It's about something different. It's about economics. There's Greece and Greece, and there's also Germany. It's an era around 1900 when there was also a sovereign debt crisis. The question is, how can you staunch this kind of crisis? Now, Thomas Mann is not suspected at all of being left-wing, of course. And he gives a very surprising response. The state is bankrupt, has a policy of austerity. Everything is becoming worse and worse. A super-rich American with a German migratory background comes along, and he brings his daughter, Immy, along with him. Have you read her name backwards, actually? It's the same as the German abbreviation for an American. So he brings this daughter. She marries into the state family, and the bankruptcy is averted. So there's redistribution thanks to this magnate. So the super rich still lives very well. He does good business as well. He purchases state bonds al pari. Thomas Mann's got a good economics background, like Goethe. He knew a great deal about economics and literature at that juncture. It's quite striking how enormously competent Goethe and Thomas Mann are in this respect. So he buys these bonds al pari, which any banker nowadays would say is complete craziness. If you buy Greek bonds at their face value rather than at a reduced rate, they'd be sent off to do a therapy with you. They'd say he's got a neurological problem. But in this case, he does good business because that makes the state more credible. And it's the classic win-win situation subsequently. He sacrificed a great deal of his private wealth, but he makes a deal, typical Thomas Mann irony. And he works with the metaphor of hands. There is the idea of debt, guilt, value, but there's also the hand. We're all in God's hands. Look at what Brecht wrote in Mother Courage. We also have the invisible hand of the state, the public hand, the private hand. Brecht, as I said, breaks with this tradition of the hand of God. So we have these people who are tied up in faith, and they believe in the invisible hand. That invisible hand of the markets is akin to that of the invisible hand of God. There's the Akudisi. Question the earthquake in Lisbon. If the invisible hand has put a price on everything and things are not so easy to identify, well, if the hand of God is, and of the markets has sorted everything out, then how can there be this earthquake akin to that in Lisbon? So there's also, in the Thomas Mann, there's the quest for the hand of the daughter. There's the notion of Faust, which in German means fist. There's the German trade term. The term trade handle also has the sound of hand in it. That means that if you have a free market economy, you have things in your hands. And when the economic experts say the market wants this, that, or the other, the market wants us to be at the same level with our currency as the dollar. They want premier for managers. Well, that's a load of nonsense. The market doesn't want anything. You can have agreements on premier any way you want, but it's in our hands. We hold the reins in our hands. So free market economy means that you have the, you don't have the invisible hand of the market at all. It's in our hands. Thomas Mann is pretty conservative, but can be this amazingly striking writer, much better than the kind of neoliberal economic theory you generally read. In this novel, there was something very surprising for me. At first, you think that the prince is going to sort things out with this magnate. The prince does studies of economics, and he's got this girlfriend who comes along, and they both study economics happily together. But at the end of the day, it's actually the father who solves all the problems. That's quite striking, is it not? Well, you can pour feminist scorn upon that, but this is the super father who solves the problem. But men are painted negatively as well as the motive of the hand. And in that era, what was meant was William II. It was well known he had a disabled hand. The same goes for Klaus Heinrich. He has a birth defect. He comes into the world with a handicap that can be resolved allegorically very quickly. He embodies the state. The public hand, the public sector, is disabled. It can no longer give and it can no longer take. You can't have the right hand knowing what the left hand does. For example, you've got the notion of the public hand, the public private hand, which is how we refer to the public sector, private sector. You've got the homo economicus cooperation principle. How is it possible that this disabled hand can be healed again? These hands meet here, the two characters, as they're reading economic texts, their hands touch, they blush. Thomas Mann refers back to the Divina Commedia. They did not read any further on that day. It's the first time that they kiss, the first time that their hands touch is after they've been reading an introduction to economic theory. It's not after reading, for example, Lancelot as, and Guinevere, unlike Dante's characters who are roasting in hell. So in this case, they go to heaven. The problems are redeemed. In the same way as you have the redemption of a loan, for example, like so many other central economic notions, they all stem from religious vocabulary. There's a whole host of overlaps, redemption, obligations, there's an enormous density of theological terms in the economic world. I must say that some economists, not all of them, there are some great economists as well, but economists say we're not actually a science. We have teach a theory. We combat other theories, erroneous teachings, for example, the erroneous teachings such as behavioral economics and neuroeconomics, and communism is an erroneous teaching. We represent the only true teaching. So economists admit that they're not academics or scientists. They struggle for the truth, and they have to combat erroneous approaches. You compared the secular sphere and the economic and made that overlap clear. What do you think that the role of the church is currently in these crises? Is that a serious question? Well, none at all. None whatsoever. It's utterly irrelevant. The church has called on people to be fair, not to exploit the poor, and so on. Donate to Oxfam or whatever. Well, they're purely irrelevant. The church no longer has any authority, perhaps in Catholic academies. Morally, neither? Well, I don't see any of this being put into practice either. Well, morally, you don't think there's any link either? Well, morally, God, I mean, I'm an atheist Protestant, so to speak. How on earth is the Catholic Church supposed to deal with it? The Protestant Church has structural problems too. I mean, if they ever had any moral capital, they've really squandered it ridiculously recently. But that's really getting us off the subject, is it not? But maybe those things all hang together. You're a psychoanalyst. I'm an amateur psychoanalyst. I've never done real psychoanalysis, although perhaps I might need one. If you look at the banking sphere, the financial sphere, it's the most masculine domain you can imagine. I can hardly imagine the head of the Deutsche Bank being female. I can't imagine any other realm that is so masculinized, and the same goes for the church. If the Catholic Church were to abandon its precept of celibacy, if the Pope were to have not a private secretary who was a man but a woman, we'd have a very different model. My thesis is that the church and the bank structure on this psychological level are very closely linked, and in psychoanalytic terms, they create homophile fraternities. What do banks do? They joke about reproduction, for they say that money can reproduce too. Just you can have children and the children of your children. You can have interest and interest upon interest. The message from men to women, if they enter the financial sphere, is we can multiply in the banking world without needing women. Reproduction, money can work for us. Leaving women out. Christina von Braun explained this very clearly as well. Christina explained about how women are not needed in the world of finance. Well, is this actually specifically, what is actually specifically female to your mind? Seen in economic terms, let's say. Oh, you're drawing me into a trap and I'm foolish enough to fall into it, am I not? Specifically female. Doubling the heart, duplicating the heart. That's important for economics, is it? Well, being procreative, reproduction. Well, we said that women don't play such an enormous role in that sector. Fair enough. Why is that then, irrespective of the question of gender roles, which have developed over centuries and certainly do have an impact there? What do you think would happen if women were to be involved? Would they act differently? Would they perhaps not have this need to have interest upon it, rate upon interest, rate interest as compound interest, like children's children? Would they manage things better? Well, let's be really tangible and not too generalized. We're just a stone's throw away from the Federal Chancellery. And I'm going to blame you because you're a psychoanalyst and you've been very wise about asking the right questions to make me look foolish. What would happen if Ursula von der Leyen, an attractive woman, mother of seven children, were to be at the same cabinet table as a federal chancellor who's the most powerful woman in the world and possibly the second most powerful person in the world who is not a mother? How is that perceived by them as people? I don't want to talk about women in general. Was Catherine the Great a better Tsar than Ivan the Terrible? Was Maggie Thatcher a better Prime Minister than Tony Blair? I would say no, no, no. But I'm not going to dig into that issue. The question is the whole cultural dispositive. And that's why it was more interesting for me to talk about the psychodynamic and psychosocial configuration of the banking sphere of the Catholic Church. I would say that both are homophilic. Structurally, functionally, they are therefore misogynist. They say, we don't need women. We can manage without them. With the Holy Virgin Mary, that's enough by way of a female presence. And she was a virgin, after all. We don't need any other women. Well, don't you think that perhaps there could be a useful impetus if women were to be involved more in those domains? Or do you think that that's just the way it is because it makes psychodynamic sense and this is what keeps the economy ticking over? What would be your thoughts on that? Perhaps from your professional career. Well, I'm looking fearfully, but hopefully, at Christina von Braun. You get a go later on, don't you? I think that the questions are ones you could answer much better. You're talking about fear and guilt. Well, I'm responding fearfully. I mean, I've really dug a big hole for myself, haven't I? Perhaps I continue. I mean, not just a young chap any longer, as you can see clearly looking at me, but if you look at what's happened over the course of my lifetime, revolutionary structural changes. I would say property relations, well, no. Political structures, no. The basic law continues to pertain after German unification, may be a good thing. I don't see any political revolutions. Nobody's come running around with a Kalashnikov asking to have my house. We've had a revolution, though, in sexual relations. That was the only successful revolution in the course of my life. A successful one, but a successful revolution has to be codified. We have the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Code, and then legal claims, legal system is restructured, and there's the so-called disappointment factor. You can't keep the promises of the revolution, but you do have the Napoleonic Code. Looking back to my youth and childhood, fortunately I'm not from a divorced family, but a woman, say, in the 50s and 60s, imagine she were divorced and found to be at blame. I tried to explain to my children what's supposed to mean being at blame. She wanted to get rid of her. She'd lost her husband, of course. She'd lost her reputation, her money, and her children. Unconceivable. So we've had the sexual revolution, not in terms of what happens between the sheets. I mean, that's of interest too, but not perhaps here for a debate up here on the panel. But gender setting, the power poles, how they've been turned around. There's a manifest revolution which has occurred there. If 25 years ago we'd been sitting together, in 87, somebody had said, well, I'll tell you how the world will look in 25 years, particularly in Germany. Germany's reunified. There's no Soviet Union any longer. A divorced woman from the GDR, a single woman from the GDR is the chancellor. Then we have a gay foreign minister and mayor in Berlin. A black guy's the president of the U.S. I mean, if I'd said that 25 years ago, they'd have said, well, Hirsch, we know you're like a tipple, but this is ridiculous. A very improbable. So I hope that some of these developments continue to unfold along these lines. We're doing much better than our general descriptions of ourselves, 60 to 70 years of peace, a sexual revolution, a really tip-top nature. We've had reunification. So incredibly much has gone so incredibly well over the last few decades that I think, well, anyone can criticize. And the task of literature is, after all, to criticize everybody. That's not really the whole story. You can criticize anybody. You can complain about the weather and the politicians and how bad men and women are and everything, but really praising fulsomely is perhaps something we shouldn't leave just up to advertisers. And that's a rather good note upon which to end, I think.